Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with author, activist, and independent scholar Barbara Smith. Barbara Smith has played a groundbreaking role in opening up a national cultural and political dialogue about the intersections of race, class, sexuality, and gender. She was among the first to define an African-American women's literary tradition and to build Black women's studies and Black feminism in the United States. She's been politically active in many movements for social justice since the 1960s. She has edited three major collections about Black women: Conditions, 5, The Black Women's Issue with Lorraine Bethel in 1979. All the Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave. Black Women's Studies with Gloria T. Hull and Patricia Bell Scott, 1982. And Homegirls, A Black Feminist Anthology, 1983. She's also the co-author with Ellie Bulkin and Minnie Bruce Pratt of Yours in Struggle, Three Feminist Perspectives on Anti-Semitism and Racism, 1984. She's the general editor of the Reader's Companion to U.S. Women's History with Wilma Mankiller, Gwendolyn Mink, Marissa Navarro, and Gloria Steinem, 1998. A collection of her essays, The Truth That Never Hurts, Writings on Race, Gender, and Freedom, was published by Rutgers University Press in 1998. Her most recent book, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around, 40 Years of Movement Building with Barbara Smith, edited by Alethea Jones and Virginia Eubanks with Barbara Smith, was published by SUNY Press in November 2014. Barbara Smith was co-founder and publisher until 1995 of Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, the first U.S. publisher for women of color. She resides in Albany, New York, and served two terms as a member of the Albany Common Council from 2006 to 2013. Barbara Smith, welcome. I'm so delighted that you're here with us. You're a very important person in our community and in the extended community in the United States. How'd you get here?
How did I get to Albany? You're not talking about transportation choices, are you? I got here in 1984. I actually was at Yaddo in the fall of 1984, but I had already decided to move to Albany. So after my couple of months at Yaddo, I moved to Albany, and I've been here ever since. I moved here from Brooklyn, and I had started with others the first U.S. publisher for women of color that had a wide reach. That was Kitchen Table Women of Color Press. The press was still in New York City, so I wanted to live somewhere that I could easily get to New York City, but I did not want to live in a suburb or a borough or any other place in connection with New York City. I was kind of done with New York at that point, so I moved to Albany, and I had a few friends here when I moved.
So let's go way back to the beginning. You were born where?
In Cleveland, Ohio.
What did your parents do?
Well, I only had one parent. We never had contact with our father. My mother was actually a college graduate. She went to a small, historically Black college in Georgia. That's where my whole family is from. And my sister and I'm a twin. I know you are too.
I am.
So we were the first children in our family to be born in the North. But our mother, as I said, had gone to Fort Valley State College, and she was actually trained to be a teacher. But when she got up to Cleveland, although she tried to do her certification and her practice teaching, she really didn't like the experiences that she was having in the schools where they were sending her. So she actually worked as a supermarket cashier.
Really?
With her college degree, which is not uncommon at all for Black people, men and women, at that time, because since private industry generally did not hire Black people in the 1940s and 50s, if you were not working in the public sector, you might very well be underemployed in relationship to your education. But the fact that she was so well educated, as were other people in our family, we really got the benefit of that, my sister Beverly and I.
So what was it like? First of all, you had a twin. You were close with your twin?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are no other siblings. That's it.
Same thing in my family. So what do you remember about, as a child, a young child, about your mother?
Well, our mother died at a very early age. She died when she was 34, and my sister and I were 9 years old.
Whoa.
So our memories of her, I always say are, because my childhood was a collective childhood, my sister and I. But my memories of her is that she was just incredibly beautiful, incredibly kind and wonderful, and really wanted us to have the best lives that we could possibly have. So when we were little, pre-kindergarten, when people would ask my sister and me, what do you want to do or be when you grow up? We said, we're going to college. And that's really kind of extraordinary for a 4-year-old of any age to be saying that. But we understood that was what we wished to aspire to. I'm sure we had a few other things in mind, too, but we actually did have college in our sights at that tender age.
Do you remember when she died?
It was devastating. I'm still devastated. I don't think anyone ever gets over a major loss like that. One learns that the world is not going to run the way it does in books or in fairy tales, and no matter how much you wish, the worst thing in the world that could happen actually can happen. So that's the way that was. She had had rheumatic fever as a child, and as I mentioned, she grew up in a small town in Georgia, Dublin, Georgia. I don't know what the level of medical care was for Black people at that time, but given that everything was segregated, I don't know how her illness was managed. And since rheumatic fever looks so much like other childhood diseases, often you get over the illness, but it has done silent damage to your heart. So that's why she died, because of the heart damage that she had experienced as a child when she had rheumatic fever.
Who told you she died?
Oh, my dear maternal aunt and my dear maternal uncle. They had gone to the hospital, and my aunt, who worked full-time at our main library in Cleveland, which was a library of record. So it was an incredible library. I always explain it was much more like the New York Public Library than any other library I've seen since. But in any event, she visited her sister every day, our mother, and that was a time when kids went to neighborhood schools. So we came home for lunch every single day and then walked back to school. So we were home at lunchtime and we heard a car pull into our driveway. And there was only one person in our family who drove, which was our Aunt LaRue. And my thoughts was, what is somebody doing driving in and getting out of the car? Sometimes people would perhaps drive in to turn around. But the thing is that they came in and the exact words were, she didn't make it. She had been in the hospital for months by that time. She went in May and she died in mid-October. Children were not allowed to visit parents or anyone else in the hospital during those years because of the level of fear about them, I guess, contracting diseases, because polio still existed at that time. Not that you'd necessarily go to a hospital and get polio, it's just that they didn't have the level of prevention and also treatment. So children were basically not allowed to go to hospitals. We got to go and see her once.
So by that time, you were already living with this aunt.
Well, we had an extended family and they had purchased a home in the early 1950s. So my maternal aunt and her husband lived on the second floor of our home, and my grandmother, a great aunt, my sister, mother, and I lived on the first floor.
Oh, boy.
So it was an extended family.
Oh, boy. So what happened then? Your aunt takes over. You're living with them. What's the level of, I don't know how to put this, but what's the level of love?
Oh, we were treated incredibly wonderfully. We were absolutely loved. I think the fact that my sister went undergraduate to the University of Chicago and I went undergraduate to Mount Holyoke, that says a lot about how much we were loved, because it was the mid-1960s and those schools were just desegregating at that time. And of course, our family had no way of knowing that the most elite colleges in this country were going to start admitting Black young people in the mid-60s. How could they know that? The civil rights movement hadn't even really gone into full gear at the time that we were born. But they made sure in their standards and what they provided for us to be involved in, they made sure that if that opportunity ever occurred, we would be ready for it. The only school they ever talked about was Spelman.
Uh-huh, because it was a Black school.
Right. Well, Black women's college. Yeah, it was like the Mecca. It was so well loved. And of course, it was in Atlanta. And we had other family members who'd actually gone to Spelman, but not for a college degree. We had a great aunt who we never met, who died in the early teens, or the early 20th century during the teens. She died, so we never met her, but she had gone to Spelman for high school, because these rural towns in the South often did not provide a 12th grade education for Black students. So our family was so educationally motivated, she actually went away to Spelman, and that's where she was able to go to high school and to graduate. But anyway, as I said, the fact that they could prepare us to go to those kinds of schools and be competitive with students who came from a very different demographic background just shows how much they cared. And they loved us in general, whether we achieved anything or not. But you couldn't really be in my family, not a chief. That was not in the game plan. And one of the things that I always say is that I don't remember ever having a conversation about you need to get these kinds of grades, you need to study, you need to do this, you need to do that around education. By the time we got to kindergarten, we knew what we were supposed to do. And we had imbibed it just through role modeling, not necessarily because somebody was threatening us with, if you don't get your homework done, if you don't do well in school, if you don't bring home A's. Nobody ever said anything like that. I don't remember ever having a conversation about grades that they sorted. We would have conversations about grades if we were not satisfied with what we got. But as I said, there was no pressure and there also was no payment. And I never got a single dime for an A.
So there was never a point at which there was a good twin and a bad twin, or a smart twin and a not-so-smart twin.
We were very evenly matched.
You were very evenly matched.
Yes.
Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
This radio station, of course, has tremendous relationship with Mount Holyoke.
I know. I love that.
Yeah. And so how did you get to Mount Holyoke? I mean, how did that happen? Was there a guidance counselor? How did you find out that there was a Mount Holyoke?
So we had a wonderful guidance counselor, but I really feel the deep answer of how did I get to Mount Holyoke is because my people, African Americans, were totally committed to struggle during my growing up years. The civil rights movement does not start in the 1950s. We can go back to the 20s, 30s, whenever we begin to see black people mobilizing around rights. The kind of official civil rights movement is usually marked by the Montgomery bus boycott and everything that happened subsequently. But those were my growing up years. The fact that my people, African Americans, were fighting for rights for the entire group, not just for my sister and me, created a context that by the time we were in high school, these colleges and universities were looking at their lack of diversity. And then there was a federal government, which if they could not prove that they were desegregating with all deliberate speed, there were federal grants and federal funding that they were no longer eligible for. So there was a pressure of the federal government. But why did they get that idea? It was because of the struggle for civil rights across the board. But to get specific, one of the reasons that our family moved to the neighborhood that they did in Cleveland is because it had some of the best schools in Cleveland, including one of the best high schools in Cleveland, John Adams High School. And it was known as a real academic powerhouse.
And integrated?
Yes. I always went to integrated schools, except for my first couple of years in elementary school. We lived in a neighborhood in Cleveland when I was first here on Earth that was called the Central Area. It was a vibrant black community that had a lot of businesses. We went to an elementary school that was right across the street from our church. And that school was virtually all black. There were very few white children in that school. We did have a white teacher. We were only there, I think, for a year and a half for kindergarten in the first part of first grade. But when we moved to the new neighborhood and our new house, as we referred to it, I will never forget preparing for school the first day of school. We went to Robert Fulton Elementary School, and our mother told us, and it was just a statement of fact, she said, there are going to be a lot more white children in your class from now on. And I don't remember her saying a single other word. She didn't say, and that's how they are, and that's how they're going to act, and this is how you need to act, blah, 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 blah. I don't remember if we asked her any questions about that, but she just wanted us to know who was going to be there. There was no editorial comments about stereotyping them or warning us.
So, Barbara Smith, how did it turn out to be?
That it was integrated?
No, I mean, everybody remembers elementary school. I sure do. I sure remember the black kids in the class. I remember, you know, hanging around and doing all of that. How was it? Was there prejudice?
Not so that we would notice. It was an integrated neighborhood because these schools drew from a wider neighborhood. Now, our street was not integrated. They may have been one or two white people left on our street because that's how desegregation, residential desegregation occurs. It's block by block. And we know the term block busting. And we also know the classic play, A Raisin in the Sun, that focuses on that phenomenon. But in any event, it was a wider kind of district or catchment area. So there were definitely streets like maybe 8 or 10 blocks away that were predominantly white. We all went to our neighborhood school.
So nobody ever called you a name?
I'll tell you when that happened and how that happened. and school itself, we really had a very positive experience. And we had a very positive experience with most of our teachers, too. There were Black teachers at our elementary school.
Right.
So it was, you know, it wasn't just that it was Black students. We did have some Black teachers. We got along with the kids who were in our class. We even were friends with some of the white children in our class and went to visit some of the children in our class. But where I first experienced racism that I could identify looking back on it as such is when my sister and I were chosen to take French when we were 8 years old at Western Reserve University. They were offering language. I don't know if there were any other languages besides French, but we were picked to participate in a summer school French class when we were 8 years old at Western Reserve University. It had not combined with Case, so I'm not making a mistake. It was Western Reserve University, and Case was a separate institution, Case Institute of Technology. In any event, it was about a three-hour class every day. We had gone to day camp the summer before, and we had loved that. So we go to the class. We love school, so what's not to like, except that we are also extremely shy. And it's really hard to learn a language if you don't put yourself out there and make mistakes in front of other people. Be that as it may, we were very quiet and we did not cause any problems. But our teacher was horrible to us. And we could not figure out why did she treat us like that? We were so used to having the adults in our entire world be very nice to us, whether it be in our family, in the neighborhood, at school, or at church. Adults generally treated us very well, including ones who are not necessarily Black. But here is this white woman, and there was another Black kid, at least one other Black kid in the class. We were in a distinct minority, but there was at least one other Black kid in the class. She treated all of us the same way. And then there was a day that...
Now, she was white.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And that was really the first time I ever experienced differential treatment based upon race. And I do believe that's exactly what it was.
Can you give us
we hated going to that class.
Can you give me an example of what
it was? Just her general meanness.
Yes.
You know, I can't tell you anything except there was not the warmth. I'm sure we got reprimands. I can't even tell you in details. I think kids are very sensitive and they have an innate sense of justice and fairness. And if somebody is not being nice or kind to them and unfair, they know it very, very quickly. And then there was a day that we begged our mother, who did work, as I've already mentioned, to make some cookies for us to share with other students, because that's what kids did during the break. So kids would bring things, usually things that their mothers had made, because that was a time when people did do that on a regular basis. And so we asked our mother, who was a great cook and a great baker, would she make some cookies for us to take? And we did do that, and most of the children in the class would not touch them.
Really?
That's correct. So.
And did anybody say anything?
I don't remember what they said, but I do know that that memory is emblazoned. Because it was not only a rejection of us, it was a rejection of our mother, I felt. And I'm angry about it to this day, because she wasn't a stay-at-home mom. She did this on her day off or in the evening, whenever she had the time to do it. And of course, the cookies were beautiful and wonderful and delicious. And it's so ironic, because I'm sure some of those children had Black women cleaning up their houses and cooking for them and doing other things for them. But that was what they chose to do. But I was very lucky. I can count these incidents on the fingers of one hand. Now, the first time the N-word was deployed,
really,
ironically, was by some children who would be called biracial now. They had a white mother and a Black father. And one of my great aunts used to babysit these children. And one day in a summer, I can't remember what summer it was, but we were still quite young, we were supposed to go over to their house and play, because there was a little girl and two younger brothers. The girl was our age, so we went over to play with her, and I'm sure she was in our class at school, I think. And one of these little brothers saw fit to call us the N-word. So that did not come from a white person. It came from a biracial person. And we never went over there again, needless to say.
Yeah. So your sister decides to go to the University of Chicago, and you decide to go to Mount Holyoke. Do you remember what that was all about?
Of course. And you wanted to know, how did that happen? So at our wonderful high school, John Adams, we were in academically talented classes. We took advanced placement classes. We were on the track for college, and not just for college, but for very competitive colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And our wonderful guidance counselor, I'm going to say that over again, our wonderful guidance counselor, who was named Evelyn White. She was a white woman, Miss White. And one day I was going to meet with her. I think these were regularly scheduled appointments. And she asked me, she said, what are you thinking about as far as college is concerned? And for whatever reason, I was already looking at women's colleges. And there was a college in Ohio at that time called Lake Erie College for Women. And so I said, well, I'm looking at or I'm interested in Lake Erie College for Women. She said, you can do better than that. And that is like, does that ever happen? She actually believed that her most talented students should go to the best colleges they could get into. And that was a very rare belief in the early 1960s in the United States of America. There was also something that had started at Yale during that period that was called the Cooperative Program for Educational Opportunity. And the person who directed that was named Shirley McCarthy. Not hard to forget that name for those of us of a certain age. But in any event, when Charlie McCarthy saw our PSATs probably, he told our guidance counselor, and I'm talking about my sister and I, he told her, have them apply to any school they want to, and they would foot the bill for the application fee. So we applied to lots of Seven Sister colleges, and my sister changed her mind about what college she wanted to go to like every 2 weeks. So she had Reed out in Oregon. Mm-hmm. She had the University of Chicago, and she had Smith. And she kept changing her mind. But as soon as I found out about Mount Holyoke in some detail, I said, that's it. I'm not really interested in the rest of them. This is the college I want to go to.
And what makes you so receptive to Mount Holyoke?
Well, one of the things, back in those days, even well-off applicants to these Seven Sister colleges, the Ivy League was closed to women at the time that I was applying. So that was off the table. So the Seven Sisters were some of the most competitive colleges in the country for young women. And even affluent young women, if you were as far away as Cleveland in those days, they did not necessarily travel to visit the college because that was considered to be a really long distance. People just did not do it in the same way that they do college visits now. But what they did have instead was they would have get-togethers with alumni, both adult alumni and sometimes students who are currently at the school. They would have these teas. That's at least what the women's colleges did. I don't know what the rest of the colleges were doing, but all of these Seven Sister colleges would have teas for prospective students. And my sister and I and another friend of ours, a couple of friends of ours who were also very, very strong students, we would go to these teas, and they were very painful experiences. Because take into account when it was. It was the early 1960s. The civil rights movement was at its height. Race was really very much front and center in people's consciousness. But yet, these people who were giving the teas, they never had black people come into their front doors for social occasions. So here we were, these bright and very eager young black female students, literally walking up to these mansions at times. But when I went to the Mount Holyoke tea, and I've been to a few already, by the time I went to the Mount Holyoke tea, the house was more modest. It was a very nice house, but it wasn't a mansion. And the people there were totally welcoming. There was no edge. There was no look on anyone's face that, what in the world are they doing there? What are they doing here? That did not happen. They were genuinely kind. My sister and I did an interview with an alumna from Wellesley. We had to travel far, far away from the center of Cleveland. She lived in, I think, I'm going to say Chagrin Falls, but I can't remember exactly where she was. I know that we went to the end of the rapid transit line, and then she picked us up. And I can't remember exactly what had happened recently when in the civil rights movement. When we did our interviews, she put one of us into another room while the other one was being interviewed. So when I went in for my interview with her, she asked me something about the civil rights movement and about the protest. And she said, if you were there, what would you do? I said, I would be there with the people who were protesting. Absolutely. I think that's how I did not get admitted to Wellesley. But that's okay.
Just fascinating stuff.
I love these questions.
Well, I love listening to you, Barbara Smith. It's just terrific. So you majored in what when you got to?
I majored in sociology and in English. I had an interdepartmental major that I created myself. I was very, very interested in studying black subject matter. And I've always been interested in literature above probably any other discipline. But one of the reasons I was drawn to sociology is that it was the only department that I could see at college where you could actually do some work on people of color and African Americans because it was sociology.
Sure.
Now, the fact that they would show up in a course called Social Problems, that might not be exactly what I wish that to be. But as I said, I did have a strong background in sociology. I did transfer to the New School for Social Research. During my junior year, they had started a new college program.
Really?
And you had to choose one area or another. You had to choose either humanities or social science. So I chose social science because I thought my background was stronger in social science and that I was better prepared to continue studying it. And that was really an incredible experience for me because these were brilliant, very young professors often. And that's where I was introduced to Marx and to Engels and Freud, the original stuff. Like nothing, you know, nothing filtered, just read it, you know.
So what made you leave Mount Holyoke and go to the New School?
I was not that happy at Mount Holyoke. It was a very difficult place for us as black students. There were less than 30 black students on campus when I arrived, around 24, 27. I can never remember the exact number. But we had a high attrition rate because it was just very, very difficult. Those expectations and that treatment that I described in that classroom with that French teacher when I was 8 years old, we got that at Mount Holyoke too. And like most of the students there, you couldn't get into Mount Holyoke if you were not an excellent student. That just didn't happen. But we were treated like we were not going to succeed. We would get the message sometimes that we were considered to be high risk and that we perhaps did not deserve to be there.
Did your sister stay in Chicago?
Yes, she graduated from the University of Chicago.
Yeah, right. Maybe that's the difference between a small school and a really large institution.
Well, she was not that happy at the University of Chicago either. These schools were not designed to make little black girls happy. They were not. Not in the 1960s. I don't know if they're designed for that now. But I have to say, there was more than a notion to go to a previously segregated, very elite, either college or university, and make your way there. And for those of us who did it, I think we feel really, really proud that we were able to endure. And I am so proud and happy that I went to the school that I went to, and they seem to be pleased about that connection as well, because I keep getting asked to come back and do different things.
I'll bet they are. Well, I lived across the street from the New School, so I wonder what moving to Manhattan was like.
That was really interesting because it was 67, 68.
Yeah.
I actually lived in the East Village. And
I was actually right across the street.
Right, right. So I would walk from the East Village to the West Village to get to school. I had always wanted to be in New York City.
Yeah.
I generally wanted to be in the East for the rest of my life, and so I got that wish. But I also really wanted to be in New York City because I was just fascinated by it. I thought it was just remarkable and wonderful. So anyway, I had the experience of living in New York City, going to school in New York City, and then it just so happened that that was the year that Columbia went out on strike. And our school, the whole school, not the, what do they call those courses, adult kind of enrichment courses.
General education.
Not them, but the college program that I was in, we shut down.
Really?
They shut us down in solidarity with what was going on at Columbia. And there were people in my classes at the New School who were part of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. I never joined SDS, but I did admire SDS because I thought they were really on to something. And I've always just been politically conscious. I was involved in the civil rights movement before I went to college in Cleveland as a high school student. That affiliation was primarily with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. And in Cleveland, a major focus of the civil rights movement at the time was school desegregation. And they made a big effort to get kids and young people who were in the schools to be involved in the movement. And that's really how I got involved.
So there you are at the New School. This is a different environment than Mount Holyoke.
Right. It was really good for me because I actually had this aspiration, and there are people who will hear this interview and they will laugh their heads off at this because they'll probably say, you never really accomplished that goal. But I think I did. I really wanted to be sophisticated. I really wanted to know what was going on, everything that was going on. I wanted to travel. One of the things I wanted to do more than anything was to travel. And I do mean internationally. I got to do that. But I really wanted to be not necessarily cool, because I probably was not going to make it to that level as a nerd. But in any event, I did want to be well aware of what was important in the world, to meet different kinds of people and to do different kinds of things. One of the things that I was able to do at the New School, we could take any course that was in their catalog for free. We could audit it. So I audited an art course and a film course, both art appreciation and film appreciation, two different courses. Now, the art course was taught by an incredible woman who was European. I don't know where she came from. I can't tell you right now where she was from. I don't know if I ever knew where she was from, but she was definitely European. And most of the people in the class besides me were middle-aged women from the suburbs of New York.
That's what the New School was famous for.
Right, exactly. So it's the incredible professor, the women who are filling their time and doing something very positive. I mean, there's nothing wrong with trying to learn more about art. And then there was me. And sometimes she would give me a look because she knew how serious I was. It would be almost like a wink. Like when a question would be asked by one of these women, like, what's the best picture in this gallery? She'd be like, oh, goodness. Are you kidding me? So I learned a lot in that course. That was a lot of fun. We mostly went to the Metropolitan in that course. And then I took the film course and I saw a lot of classics. So it was fun. I loved all that.
I remember I had to take one graduate course while I was at Hunter by a famous professor named Richter, who was talking about the correspondence between Tocqueville and Gobineau. And there were some people in the class. I don't want to characterize them by gender. But every time this very serious scholar would say something, somebody would say, that's the way my Timmy is to my Jimmy. And the professor would go, which reminded me so much of what you just said about the lifting of the eyes by your professor in the art class.
Was that person comparing her children to the relationship between those two men?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was very heady stuff. I didn't understand what the guy was talking about.
Oh, I mean, how can you understand it?
But he was a wonderful man, and he did a great job. Anyway, Barbara, you graduate from the New School.
No, from Mount Holyoke. I went back to Mount Holyoke.
Oh, you went back to Mount Holyoke.
Yeah, I graduated from Mount Holyoke.
Okay.
The New School was my junior year abroad.
And then you go back to Mount Holyoke. Isn't that interesting? And you graduate from Mount Holyoke.
That's correct.
And then what happens?
Well, I went immediately to graduate school. I had decided by that time, my senior year, I came back to Mount Holyoke really, really primed to do serious academic work. I had always been serious, of course, about my studies, but the experience of being at the New School was so wonderfully reinforcing because, for one thing, they didn't give grades. They only did evaluations. But as I said, I was surrounded by these incredibly distinguished people who came distinguished, young scholars. I'm thinking specifically of Elizabeth Menick. I don't know if you're familiar with her or not, but she was one of my teachers. Wow. And in any event, I came back then having gotten really good grounding in social theory because, as I said, we were reading the original great thinkers in these classes. And it was a different kind of, somewhat different kind of approach than at Mount Holyoke. But there was another thing that happened. There was a young professor who had just started at Mount Holyoke during my senior year, and she had gotten her PhD from the New School. So we had a real kind of bond because she knew what kind of education I had gotten there. And she was in social theory. She was a sociologist. And so she was one of my academic advisors. And then I had a wonderful person in the English department who was my other academic advisor, Mr. Richard Johnson, unfortunately now deceased. But in any event, I decided to do an independent study on African-American writers because there was no course that I could take on African-American writers. And I did it very, very, very thoroughly. It was extremely long and well-researched paper. My advisor, Mr. Johnson, really wanted me to be able to get honors for having done that level of work, but because I had some lower grades in my first couple of years at Mount Holyoke, I didn't have the GPA that would allow me to graduate with honors or for that paper to be considered an honors thesis, although in every other way, he felt that it qualified. I do remember I took a couple of courses with him, and one was in American literature, and there was a student in my dormitory who was in the same class. She's a junior and I was a senior. So I asked her if she would pick up my paper that had been graded instead of me having to go get it. Not that I had picked up many papers, but it was just convenient. So she said she would pick up the paper for me. And when she handed me the paper, she looked at me as if I had arrived from another planet because the grade was A+. I loved it. I love literature. I love reading, studying, all those things.
So what did you pick for graduate school?
I went to the University of Pittsburgh because I wanted to be nearer to Cleveland than I had been. And with those transportation issues that were still kind of part and parcel of the way life was in the United States at the time, flying was expensive, although they did start student half fares during that era. So I started being able to fly home following, you know, the airlines making those fares available. But sometimes I would have to take the train. And that was an incredibly long distance to go by train from Massachusetts to Cleveland. So I just felt like I really would like to be nearer awesome. Home. And as it turned out, it was a positive decision because 2 years later, my dear aunt who had raised us died. So I was actually nearer to home, although not at home. I was nearer to home during those 2 years than I had been when I was in college. And also because I had an interdepartmental major, I didn't necessarily have all of the requirements for graduate school in literature that would be expected. So like I applied to Berkeley and I actually got admitted to Berkeley, but I got admitted to Berkeley in sociology because I was kind of hedging my bets and giving myself opportunities. So this was a school that accepted my background as being adequate for studying literature.
And did you go all the way through to a PhD?
I transferred to the University of Connecticut to work on my doctorate, and I did everything except for complete the dissertation.
And when did you start to write?
I was writing during those years. That was really one of the things that kind of got me out of graduate school, because I always had wanted to write. I also was teaching during those years as well. And because I was beginning to write and to publish and work on some major projects, it was kind of like I'm already there. And then my wonderful advisor at the University of Connecticut, Donald Gibson, he went to another institution. And he was an African-American with expertise in African-American literature, which was incredibly fortunate for me. But when he left, I'm sure if he had stayed at the University of Connecticut, that story might have ended a little bit differently. But one of the things that I was doing during...
The story meaning you didn't...
I might have finished had he continued to be there. I think he would have encouraged me. And I also would have had an advisor who actually knew the field. There was nobody else who knew the field there.
Do you ever look back, Barbara Smith, on that decision about the degree, about the writing the dissertation with regret?
Sometimes, but not overwhelmingly so. I've had the opportunity to do so many things. And the fact that my last two books were published by university presses kind of...
I should say.
Yeah, kind of says, obviously, I have led a life that and done work that people at these university presses see as valuable.
And don't you think the Academy sometimes puts too much weight on a degree as opposed to, I mean, look at what you've done and what you have to offer and all your books and your incredible life. And yet, you know, having sat on a number of faculties and having made this argument a number of times, it gets crazy sometimes that people look at a PhD as being the end all when it's not.
Well, the thing about a PhD is that, as far as I am concerned, it is about research, being able to do original research that is thorough and that is also valid. So that, to me, is the value of doing a dissertation if you do a good dissertation. It's to teach you how to dig deep, to have new and innovative ideas, and to come up with theories that are intellectually credible. That's what a dissertation does for you. And other than that, you know, that's what it's for. So I don't think that it's without value at all. I've had many friends. I knew lots of people who were in different grad schools at the time, particularly when I lived in Boston, because there are so many institutions there. I met a lot of different Black women in particular and have remained friends with some of them throughout the years. The stories that I have heard about their general life as academics, again, a minority being in a vast minority at their distinguished institutions as faculty, and also the struggles that many of these colleagues and friends have told me about when they go for tenure, it is miserable. I don't know how it's changed, because I don't have as many friends.
And you think it's based
scholars.
On gender and racism?
Oh, yes, because the thing is, that thing about collegiality, that's no joke as far as how you are viewed, I think, in your department and how your academic work is viewed. I think it's really, really hard to this day for people who are thinking outside of the box and whose identities don't conform to the stereotype of who a scholar is. I think it's still hard. As I said, I don't have any concrete recent incidents to describe, but I certainly know that for people in my age group who are in graduate school and then went on to pursue an academic career that they had challenges. And there are lots of things that happen in academic contexts that one would be surprised.
What do you consider your greatest professional success?
I don't know if this is my greatest professional success. What I'm proudest of is building Black feminism in the United States. I think that's a thing that, if I had not been involved, would be different than it is currently. There are so many people who I think have benefited from the work that I have done, and they have no idea who I am, and they never heard of me. I'm just reading now and almost have finished a book that came out this past fall, that's called Bad Feminist. It's by Roxane Gay. It was a New York Times bestseller. She is a Haitian American. She's incredibly bright. Her field is literature and writing. She's written a novel and also a collection of short stories. One of the things that interests me about the book is that her lack of familiarity with the roots of Black feminism and of the women's movement generally sometimes just stands out. It's like, oh, Roxane, you did not know that? But I'm not really talking to her. I'm reading the book. But as I said, there are people who rely on the work. The concept of intersectionality, which some people are familiar with, that is often talked about these days, particularly on MSNBC, if I may mention that. The young anchors on MSNBC will talk about intersectionality, as will their guests.
Can you give us a little definition?
Intersectionality is something that we developed to better understand the situation of ourselves as women of color, who were not just people of color, but also female, and who also have an economic status, gender status, a sexual orientation status. It was our efforts to say it's all of these together that shapes our experience. And if we're going to really understand what's going on, we have to look at all of these factors. And now people talk about intersectionality just like it just rolls off the tongue. It's very easy. It was actually Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a law professor, who coined the phrase and did serious writing about the concept of intersectionality. It was based upon the work of Black feminists some years before who talked about intersecting identities, intersecting oppressions. So really, the work that I did with others to build Black feminism and that inclusive point of view, the Black Lives Matter movement really owes a debt to Black feminism and the organizing that we were doing in this 1970s and beyond. So that's what I'm proudest of, that we spoke up. Beyoncé at the Video Music Awards, I didn't see it myself. I saw it reported. But there was a point when she came out on stage, and behind her in huge, huge, glittering letters was the word feminism. She samples something from a TED Talk by an African Black feminist, and it's incorporated into one of her songs. Does she know anything about the Combahee River Collective, a small group in Boston that wrote the Combahee River Collective statement where we first put these ideas out? Probably not. But as I said, a lot has changed. We have, I love popular culture, we have How to Get Away with Murder on TV, you know, Shondaland on Thursday night. We have Scandal. We have Black women who are the focal points of these really very interesting shows. My favorite is Empire, actually. Cookie Lyon, please. I'd love to meet Cookie, but I already have, because Cookie is so familiar to anybody who's ever been a Black woman who grew up in this country. We all know someone like Cookie, if we don't know half a dozen people like Cookie. But be that as it may, this is all happening now in real time in 2015. But back in the 1970s, the mid-1970s, 40 years ago, we were nowhere to be found. We were nowhere to be seen. So I'm very proud that I could be a part of that effort.
Do you remember the first time you saw a published book of yours?
Well, the first major publication that I did was actually a special issue of a literary magazine, which was called Conditions. I think you mentioned it in the introduction. And Conditions was a wonderful literary magazine that people like Adrienne Rich and Audre Lorde and all kinds of people, Judy Grahn, Pat Parker, all kinds of people who were doing pivotal and groundbreaking work at the time contributed to. And I had met Adrienne Rich because I actually met her sister, Cynthia Rich, before, because she lived in Cambridge. And I met then Adrian through Cynthia, and Adrian had written something for the first issue of Conditions, and she told the editors at Conditions, and they were down in Brooklyn. I lived in Boston at that time. She told them that they should get in contact with me, and they did. And I wrote something that most people consider to be a classic essay at this point, and that was Toward a Black Feminist Criticism. And that was published in, I think, 1977 or so. And then, as a result of having that relationship with them, I was asked to edit a special issue of Conditions, and that was Conditions 5, the Black Women's Issue. Every one of their issues had the number incorporated into its title. So I wrote Toward a Black Feminist Criticism for Conditions 2, and then I co-edited Conditions 5, the Black Women's Issue. It is a collector's item at this point, but it was the first widely distributed collection of Black feminist and lesbian feminist writing in the United States, and it sold out its first printing within weeks.
You don't sound like you're an angry person. You sound like you're a positive person. You smile a lot, but on the other hand, you dealt with some of the most oppressive issues in our society.
That's true, and it's really interesting that you would say that I don't come across as an angry person. I don't think I really lead with anger either. As I always say, I'd much rather shed light than heat. Heat being anger and conflict, light being enlightenment and information. So I would rather go that route. And obviously, that's my profession in different ways, either as a teacher, as a writer, as a publisher. I generally have been involved in getting solid information and art, written literary art, out to people so that they can begin to understand better who we are and where they're living. Most people in the United States don't really know what country they're living in. And I'm referring specifically to ongoing white supremacy. The election of President Obama did not end white supremacy in this country. Nothing has ever ended white supremacy in this country. And what we see during this historical period with these egregious murders of Black men and young men and boys at the hands of the police and also at the hands of vigilantes and individuals at times, that's the legacy of white supremacy. And as I said, white supremacy has never really been addressed and dismantled. Discrimination has. Racism has. Race relations have been addressed, but not white supremacy. So I get angry about injustice. I don't really get angry just to be angry.
You have a button on it that says stop the violence. Why are you wearing that button?
I wear this button every day. I always have worn different political buttons during different periods of my life. This is the one that I wear now. It was created by our anti-violence initiative here in Albany, which is called Cure Violence, but it used to be, well, it's still called SNUG, which is gun spell backwards, but Cure Violence is actually Chicago ceasefire model. So I was very instrumental in bringing ceasefire and SNUG to Albany. And this is a button, as I said, that they created. And I think it applies to everything, every single day. It's hard for me to watch the news these days because of what's going on internationally, the incredible atrocities, the threats, the murders. It's just really difficult. So however you read this button, and most people never even ask me about it, it is what you think it is. It could either be street violence, gun violence, violence against young people and children, child abuse, violence against women. It can be any and all of those things. It could be the kind of incredible violence, terrorist violence that has happened most recently in Copenhagen. So whatever you think it is, it applies, and I will probably wear it until violence ends.
Do you have any hope?
Do I have hope?
Yeah.
I always have hope politically. I have a great deal of hope politically because I come from a people and from a historical experience that appeared to be hopeless at the time, but did indeed change. And I always say that if anybody had asked, like in 1682, 1754, 1811, if you'd asked the question during any of those random years, will slavery ever end in the United States? The answer would not have been no. It would have been hell no. It's never going to end. Why would it? It was incredibly lucrative. It built this country. That and the genocide of the indigenous people who already lived here and were not discovered, but they definitely were annihilated by and large, not completely, thank goodness. But in any event, That's what built the wealth of the United States of America. But yet, in the mid-1800s, it got to a point where this total contradiction in relationship to U.S. democracy had to be addressed. And that was a civil war, which was a war in which more people lost their lives than any of the other wars, I guess perhaps any of the other wars combined. But be that as it may, as I said, in those years leading up to the Civil War, starting in 1619 with the first importation of African enslaved people, there was no reason to think it would ever end. And there are people on earth today in the United States who are very sorry that it ended, or at least that Jim Crow isn't still very much in place. But be that as it may, coming out of that history, that heritage, that tradition, I know that struggle can result in change. My social status changed during my lifetime. When I was born in 1946, I was a Negro, a colored person, and I won't say the other words, but that was my status. I was also a girl. And yet, as time went on, we did some transformation. Some people would say we did some revolution. I'm not sure that we did. But in any event, we made changes. I'm talking about my people, not me personally. But people made changes so that by the time I was in college, I was a black person. I was an Afro-American. And that was a distinct status change from the time I was born in the mid-1940s until now.
What happens now?
I think that what is going on in this country is for as the nationwide movement concerning a criminal injustice system and mass incarceration, that's extremely important. The fact that the organizing continues is really, really important. The fact that young people, diverse young people, are really alert and vitally connected to these issues, this is really, really positive. What's so hard about making political and social change is that you never really know exactly if you are being successful, perhaps until years later. And I saw one of Malcolm X's daughters on television this past weekend. She has a new young adult book about her father, which I look forward to reading. She had some criticisms of the movement because I think she thought that is of the Black Lives Matter organizing against police brutality, etc. I think she wanted more substantive, like, strategy. But, I mean, we can always be critical and do better than we're doing. But I think that we're living in a time when we're seeing great injustices being confronted by great courage to make those injustices disappear.
Barbara Smith, you are one of the great assets of the Capital Region of New York. We know that. And you ran for political office, and you won, and you served. Then you left. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I got started really late with running for office and being involved in electoral politics. And I just knew I could use, you know, just using a calendar, I knew what age I would be by the time I ended my second term. And I knew, even though I had not experienced the consul job and the long, long, mostly nighttime hours that a consul member has to fulfill, even though I had not experienced it, I had a feeling that by the time I am X age, and I've already said how old I am, but by the time I get to the end of 2013, two terms will be quite enough. And then I also think that it's really important to have turnover in leadership and not to necessarily just be and stay there indefinitely.
But it isn't that you felt that you were frustrated by the, you
know, not at all. No, I actually made the decision about how many terms I wished to serve before I started serving. So it had nothing to do with anything as far as the content. And I think that my being involved as a council member representing the 4th Ward, which includes Arbor Hill and North Albany, and I had lots of different neighborhoods, even some in the South End, but I think that I learned so much. I love to learn, obviously, and I learned so much by having a chance to serve on the Albany Common Council, and I think that I tried to make a difference. I hope that I did, but I definitely did not decide not to run again because I was discouraged or thought that, no, this is not worth my time. I'm very pleased that other people have continued.
I've got a minute. Why don't you tell us a little bit, in a minute if you can, about the new book?
The title of my book is Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around, 40 Years of Movement Building with Barbara Smith. It is co-edited by Alethea Jones and Virginia Eubanks. Both Alethea and Virginia were professors at UAlbany at the time that we started the project, but Alethea now is the director of political education for 1199, mm-hmm. SEIU down in New York City. She is in politics, and Virginia is in women's studies and technological studies. So I had known both of them before we started on the book. I did not know either of them well. They are angels because they did everything for this book just because. They get no academic credit because it is not an originally researched book, although a lot of research was done for the book. It is a series of interviews. There was an editor at SUNY Press who, when she found out I lived here, wanted to get together with me and wanted to propose a book. And since I was not thinking about writing a book as a member of the council and being so incredibly busy, she suggested, and this is what she wanted to do anyway, she wanted to do a book of new interviews with me done by people who also have excelled in the fields that I have been a part of. So that's kind of the organizing principle of the book. So we have my early years, which was not originally an interview done for the book, but that works very well with the rest of it. We have black feminism. We have black women's studies. We have lesbian and gay liberation. We have publishing. We have other kinds of political organizing. And then we have my time as an elected official. So those are that's the way that the book is organized. But it also has photographs in it. It includes some work of mine that never appeared anywhere past its first publication. So there's just a lot of material in the book that I hope people might enjoy.
Well, it sounds fantastic. We've been in conversation with author, activist, and independent scholar Barbara Smith. Barbara, I can't tell you what this means to us. We're so delighted that you joined us, and we know how busy you are. And again, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.